This is Richard Wilson speaking. Thank you for downloading One Foot in the Podcast. So I'm a wrinkly, crinkly, but don't shed a tear. I'm not exactly a little old dear. One thing for sure, I'm still bloody well here. One foot in the grave. One foot in the grave. One foot in the grave.
Hello? Hello?
Hello, dear one-footers. Hope you're all well. Firstly, I'd like to apologise for the sound quality. I mean, at the best of times, it's not great, but I'm encountering many technical difficulties with the software I usually use. I'm actually recording into my phone, which ironically might actually turn out better. I'll let you decide, but anyway, sorry in advance if it comes out a bit crap.
People have asked me
Dave Remick's one-foot novel over the last couple of years, One Foot in the Grave and Counting, and whether I put out a review on it. Since I'm no avid reader, I couldn't see myself ever completing the book, even if there is, you know, there or thereabouts some new one-foot material. I just don't have the patience and, to a certain extent, the time to read a book. And on top of that, just remember the plot lines, the one-liners, and other developed storylines for the purpose of the podcast. Yeah, I just don't. But then I thought, well, I do waste a lot of time doing not much else in the small window of an evening once the children are asleep and I'm not at work. So for a fair few weeks, I'll be reading David's novel, which was published in October 2021, making notes along the way, which, by the way, that took a lot of time. And reading and making notes, yeah, that just took double the length of time I'd usually take to read a book. And like I said, I don't often read. But articles, yes, books, no. So yes, it was a lot harder making notes, you know, whilst reading the novel compared to watching a TV episode One Foot and making notes. But anyway, at the time the book was released, I was actually reading his first One Foot novel in October of that year it came out. A big up to friend of the pod, Darren, for sending me his copy, which that particular book was also in the month of October, but in 1992. I'm afraid I cannot remember much of the book. So yeah, I completed that book. But at the time I was reading it, it was amongst all the stresses and excitement of waiting for the arrival of our second born, and also being a little under the weather at the time. But one highlight I do remember it's the extended storyline about the window cleaner chap who had been run over by Gene Warboys, I believe, in the worst horrible. And this chap was mistaken as Cousin Wilf. This particular storyline is quite a dark and twisted one. From memory, and I'm sorry, it's a little disorganised for me, but basically, Faux Wilf, should we call him, wanders off into the other BBC studios while still neurologically disabled, should we say, or concussed, and eventually dies during the BBC 9 o'clock news. But yeah, the book is decent, so just to make it clear, going on about the first book here, and it covers the first two series. Not in the order they were shown, and much like this newer novel, does retell some of our favourite storylines with added bits, a few different references chucked in with some new material. I suppose, actually, come to think of it, I don't call it the highlight, but the most standout storyline in the first book was a little bit on Stuart Meldrew, which I have taken a picture of that particular chapter, or paragraph, should I say. And it's on Twitter or Instagram, so you'll be able to go and find it. But it just gives a little bit more background into the death of their son. It's incredibly sad. Since you've signed up to spoilers, basically, he was born absolutely fine, was kidnapped by some unwell woman. And for about 5 days, they had no sign of their baby returning. The sixth day in, the baby was rescued, thankfully, but died of heart failure of some kind. So yeah, really, really, really tragic, basically. But a little Easter egg in the book is that he was born the same date as our very own David Remick. So very nice. Not nice, nice touch, but at the same time, yeah, very, very tragic part of that first book. But anyway, here to talk about the second, but the newer book, One Foot in the Grave and Counting. Before we get into that, I'd like to thank those for listening to the last episode, which centred around Dave Renwick's other masterpiece in Jonathan Creek. I appreciate that some of you haven't watched Creek before, but still went to the trouble of listening to me and my pal waffle on for the best part of an hour with absolutely no structure whatsoever. Some of you found it endearing, some of you might have got bored. Hopefully you'll still stay subscribed to One for the Podcast as a result. I think we might return to a later date and do maybe another Jonathan Creek episode and actually review one of our favourite episodes and perhaps include my brother James of Very Nearly an Armful podcast, the Tony Hancock pod. Very, very good podcast with the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society. Yeah, hopefully David himself will join us for a chat as well. Mate, who knows, on a separate date. I think he's up for a little one-off chat about his other marvellous creation. So anyway, on to One Foot in the Grave and Counting, something that the press deemed, and I say this with air quotes, bringing Victor back to life. Well, we know that's impossible, but we understand the subtext here. We're bringing Victor back to life in modern media, shall we say. We're getting Victor Meldrew on the lips of comedy fans, and hopefully that magics up some more listeners for me, you know, rather selfishly. But it's nice that Victor Meldrew has spoken about, well, One Foot in the Grave has spoken about once more in, you know, more mainstream press. If you didn't already know, by the way, and I should probably use the ITV BBC News jingle for this segment like I did once before. I thought it was going to be a regular thing, but I never kept it up. But so One Foot News in that Channel 5 will be airing a One Foot documentary called 30 Years of Laughs. I guess it should be 33 Years of Laughs. It does have the same ring to that title, but yeah, it's fantastic that they're going to give us an up-to-date documentary. I was informed by previous guest of the pod, Richard Drew, TV and film production designer and art director for Series 4. He'd given me the heads up, actually, a short while ago. It's obviously privileged information, obviously. Couldn't mention it, but obviously it's out there in the public domain now. So he took part in that documentary, as did Chris Gernon, actually, who also was kindly guested on this pod. But yeah, that's obviously... Oh, by the way, I've had a few of you kindly... Well, asking if I was taking part in it, which obviously very flattering to even think for a moment an ordinary fan of a sitcom would even be considered. I'd obviously love to have taken part, but I wasn't asked. But, you know, what can you do? If I were to be on there, they'd have to have done a number of takes with me because I probably wouldn't be able to articulate the words to describe my love for the show. And I probably would have had a complete brain freeze on some of my favourite moments knowing me. So... probably save them time and money not bringing me on. To be fair, I guess some of you did ask because the Keeping Up Appearances documentary that went out by the same production company, Studio Crook, the podcast host of that show, Keeping Up Appearances, they were invited on and took part in the documentary. But I've since learned that they're media professionals and therefore I suppose they have an advantage over me in that department. But anyway, thanks for even asking if I'd be... on a mainstream documentary, very flattering. But no, I am still a mainstream documentary virgin at this stage. What I will say is, again, using the word flattering, it's flattery, but the Richard Drew said the production are aware of this podcast. That's very nice of them. At the same time, is that a bit of a insult that they still didn't want to invite me? I don't know. Did they listen to the podcast and think, bloody hell, he does not know what he's talking about? Anyway, doesn't matter. I really look forward to the documentary. Obviously, we've had the I Don't Believe It, One Foot in the Grave story, which Angus Deaton presented, if I recall. I think that might have been on the DVD extras. It might be I think it was aired after the finale, the Things Aren't Simple Anymore, back in 2000, 2001. I know the finale is 2000, but I don't know if it came a bit later. I feel like once the finale aired, Angus Deaton's documentary on One Foot was like almost like the next day. I can't quite remember. Then you've got Owen Brenham's YouTube documentary clips, of course, from behind the scenes that many of you I know have seen. And of course we had the 2004 Britain's Best Sitcom skit of One Foot in the Grave, which was presented by Roland Riven. One Foot in the Grave came 10th, so that's not bad out of 100. Clearly argue that it should finish even higher, certainly in the top 5. But you know, we live in a democracy, and the votes. I mean, if it was cast again, I wonder where One Foot would finish. Would you have Vicar of Dibley finishing, I think, second or third? Yeah, Vicar of Dibley came third. Just to remind you of the order it finished, I think you'll know Fools and Horses, deserved winners. You know, could it be One Foot in the Grave? I'd have voted either or. Second, Blackadder. Third, Vicar of Dibley. Fourth, Dad's Army. Fifth, Fawlty Towers. Sixth, Yes Minister. Seventh, Porridge. Eighth, Open All Hours. Ninth, The Good Life. And of course, One Foot in the Grave, number 10. If that poll went out again, I really don't think Open All Hours or The Good Life would get in that top 10. I think you'd find The Office going straight up there. I think Alan Partridge would be in there as well, replacing those two comedies. Because obviously in the last 20 years, you've a new generation, a new wave of comedy fans who watch those comedies I just mentioned time and time again. And legions of fans would be voting for those classics in Partridge and Office and so forth and Peep Show. So yeah, I think they've cast several different polls over the last 20 years. And yeah, I think Fawlty Towers might come out on top for one particular quite well-known poll. But yeah, anyway, deviating as ever. Let's get into the book One Foot in the Grave and Counting.
One foot in the grave.
I'll start off by reading the prologue to the book, but before that, a brief message to Ellie Renwick, wife of David, which simply reads, "For Ellie, to whom I owe everything." So that's a very sweet opener. And by the way, if you haven't worked it out yet, massive spoilers, I will be breaking down chapter by chapter, and there are just 6 of them. And within those chapters, there will be very familiar storylines, which at different stages of the book, I changed my mind on the direction of my note-taking. So some elements to the storylines I do gloss over because you and I are more than familiar of those particular moments of the show. But in others, I do give a bit of description of what's going on to the contrary. So there will be times where I go, oh, this next bit is about this part of Starbound, but I'll move on to the next moment. Other times I will actually go into some detail. It's pretty inconsistent. If I did go into detail, it's probably because it was relevant. But I'm recording this sort of a week after finishing the book, and I can't really remember my trail of thought. So on to the prologue then of the book. Why? Just about said it all in Victor's mind. As a personal philosophy, it pretty much covered everything. The distillation of God knows how many centuries, metaphysical discourse and head-scratching, and a rather more elegant rework of his earlier postulate, what's the bloody point? Come to think of it, that doctrine could be bored down still further, couldn't it, to its purest non-verbal essence. Deeper than you couldn't go. In a world growing ever more polluted by certainties, the question mark was the only sensible break on our desperate rush towards answers. Or was it? Victor couldn't be at all sure. Which is what makes him something of a hero in our story. Like I mentioned earlier, there will be spoilers. I'm reviewing this like I used to with the podcast TV series. It's going to be almost scene by scene, but it's chapter by chapter. Please don't let it put you off from buying the book. You know, there'll be bits I might have missed out unintentionally. But I would recommend reading it just to give you a full picture of what's going on, as opposed to some of the breakdown and highlights that I'll be giving you today. But yes, there are going to be spoilers, quite obviously speaking. So chapter 1. It's called From the Underworld. A descriptive opening from Renwick as he paints a murky picture as we're acquainted with another day in the life of Victor Meldrew. Comments on today's world in drivers checking texts, mowing down pedestrians with a strong hint of the UK and some unnamed country's relations, escalating, which evokes a Cobra meeting with the PM. And this is something that is repeated throughout the chapters. And it does make you think, you know, what's the underlying message here? But it reads, the dystopian future was now well into its third week and mankind's extinction at done deal. Somewhere in the southeast, RAF fighter jets were being scrambled while the Prime Minister chaired an emergency meeting of the Cobra Committee. And the nation rejoiced. And that's something we're going to hear throughout this novel. And it's there to make you think about what's going on in Victor's world in terms of its relevance and looking at the bigger picture. It's saying that life goes on. Victor's life is essentially irrelevant in the grand scheme of things. This will be mentioned throughout, basically. Meanwhile, Victor is ready for another day's work, ready to work on a farm. As we hear the radio playing nearby where host Catty Kelly is introducing Dr. Matthew Holliday to discuss impotence and infertility, noting the name Jack Holliday used in Jonathan Creek episode Jack in a Box for any Jonathan Creek fans. Victor's bemoaning the so-called service carried out on his Honda Ballard and suspect it's been joy-ridden due to the smell of seaweed in the air filter. And that is a reference from one of the One Foot episodes, and I just couldn't think of it for the life of me. I think it might have been... No, it's gone. I thought I had it then, but didn't prepare for that moment. Back to the radio show where the caller, Sharon from Doncaster, asking if it's possible to reverse a circumcision after 14 years, but it's unsure if it would still fit. Taken from Futility of the Fly, of course. And the scene switches to Riverbank and Gene Warboys, an early Gene, is visiting to use the Meldrew's laptop after there's an overnight storm damaged her phone line. It sounds like she's quite obsessed with it and she can't keep her eyes off the screen, letting copious amounts of coffee run cold, we're told. First of the more modern and relevant celebrity references here, Victor walks in after bemoaning more litter in the garden when sarcastically reeling off what was not found litter-wise in the dahlias. Specifically, no bloodied bits of Jeremy Clarkson from a roadkill clogging up the carburetor. The Dutchman one-line is used this time to speculate that life was out to get Victor. And if it wasn't, then he was a Dutchman, so used slightly differently to how it was in Futility of the Fly. Bemoaning his unreliable vehicle to Margaret, who said that's what you get for buying it off someone called Honest Sam. Learning why Gina's using the laptop is due to a pen friend she's been in contact with, and the last pen friend would have presumably been Afonso by letter. But Mrs. Wallboys is distraught as her pen friend called Chesney has been told he has 3 months to live, and leading you down the wrong path, this is, when assuming this was for health reasons, reveals he's actually a felon and is doing time for murder. And Victor humorously states that when they learned he was a family butcher, they didn't think he wasn't in the business of selling sausages. Victor's hopelessly trying to find cycle clips to ride to work. Mrs. Wallboys actually offers a lift, which is very kind of her. And we learn it's the Meldrews' anniversary and they're off to a dinner. Jean wishes them well, but needlessly states... Now, this is a very Jean Wallboys thing to do, and I actually want to read it as it's written in the book. So this is just as Jean is about to leave the house to take Victor to work. "I'll just get my coat. Bye then, Margaret, and I'll give you a ring later. Oh, and have a wonderful meal tonight, won't you, on your anniversary? I've not been to the restaurant myself, but I'm sure it's lovely. Yes, thanks, Jean, and thanks for the card. You can't go by what they say on TripAdvisor. People love to put disgusted when they probably mean just average. That's something I've learned over the years." So a wonderful putting a foot in it, Jean Wallboys line, early doors there. I suppose that almost mirroring the quote in series one when the Meldrews are off to Greece for a couple of weeks. But nice modern reference in TripAdvisor. I think people still refer to TripAdvisor. I certainly do. Also, that quote I read out there from Jean, it does smack of only a story when she's tasting Margaret's food, where she says it could be disgusting or tasteless. Very funny. I've written, it's hard to know if this is Victor post-retirement, early days or not, but it's referenced they've been married 40 years. So I don't know if he's just retired, he's in the early days, or is actually more close to the year 2000, but it doesn't actually mention it. So Jean exits with Victor. And by the way, this Chesney is described as being a young, black, handsome man, as Margaret takes a little sly look at the laptop that Jean got to shut down. In Jean's car, we learn she has a puppy, a spaniel called Oscar, who she's taken to the vets en route to taking Victor to work. I didn't really see any logic in that. He's also made to sit in the back seat of the car. Oscar obviously is a companion for Jean after talking about Chris walking out on her. He's also apparently a sniffer dog, and he's got this quite unique and special skill in being able to sniff out bowel cancer. I don't know if it's the worst horror of all or a different episode where Jean leads you down the wrong path and talking about, I don't know if it was Oscar or another name, whatever, and you think she's talking about a child or a grown-up son, but she's actually talking about her dog. So she does have a dog in the series as well. There's some funny descriptions written on how slow Jean drives as ever, with being overtaken by three men pushing a transit van and not noticing the school kids performing slow motion chariots of fire as seen in the rear mirror. She just doesn't notice it at all. As Victor is eventually dropped off at the farm, we quickly learn of his main duty, actually, taken from, of course, Wisdom of the Witch, if you didn't work that out by now, to hunt the farmer's wedding ring. Not equipped with a metal detector, unfortunately. Later that day, and into the evening, actually, Margaret and Victor at a Vietnamese restaurant, as Victor asks how the driving instructor, Mrs. Smedley, is going on. She's getting there, Margaret says, and she can drive downhill without covering her eyes. Victor comments on her poor sense of direction. And again, it's all taken from that scene where Margaret challenges him. What do you mean by that? You know, who else, you know, sits on the toilet facing the cistern? Margaret talks about a witch she's visited. Same thing as Wisdom of the Witch, Mr. Dimmickens from the sweet shop. So she's talking to Victor about that whilst you do hear a loud, obnoxious American on the phone in the background. In no time at all, really, Victor does his thing, dashes past several dinner tables, apparently gatecrashing half a dozen selfies. I mean, imagine capturing this in the flesh anyway. But Victor does approach the gentleman. And after Victor rants towards this chap, who was with apparently three younger females, we cut to the Meldrews, where Margaret is taking her frustrations out on Victor, why he has to pick all these fights all the time. And Victor's obviously a bit bruised and battered, and apparently not by the brash and loud American, but he was basically beaten up by the three women using some sort of bronze statue. So a slightly different take on what we saw in Wisdom of the Witch. So as Victor is licking his wounds, he makes some passing comments that marry up to the drinking culture of today and says how the women are worse than the men. Although Victor acknowledges that if you stand up for what you believe in, expect to have a very clear understanding of the implications, such as taking your life into your own hands. But I think that's surely always been the way, but only now is he recognising it in more modern times. The comments written by David, but not in quotations, reveal the dismay at society and turning a blind eye to too many things in the world. No public indignation and a sort of a lack of moral support, I suppose. Turns out Mark has had a few wines, is somewhat remorseful for taking out her frustrations on Victor. She acknowledges the 12 red roses which she receives every May the 6th for the last 40 years. So, yeah, 12 red roses. That's a very romantic gesture from Victor. I'm going to assume May the 6th. Well, not assume, but I'm going to hazard a guess that that's David and Ellie Renwick's anniversary date, because that date couldn't have just been plucked from the air. That'll be a little Easter egg, I'm sure. And Victor would write, "From your loving husband." So that's actually really romantic and thoughtful of Victor Melger, actually. As the pair of them get ready to sleep, Margaret starts to reminisce about when they first met, which is taken straight from Rearranging the Dust, and speaking of Carol Hawksworth's engagement party, recalling the amusing tale of the power cut, reaching out for the wrong man and ending it with Victor. The anecdote is kept the same as Rearranging the Dust, when Victor was laying on fairly thick about how Margaret was always his first choice, but the feeling wasn't mutual, which is quite brutal, really, isn't it? I mean, it's all happy. Well, I say all happy now, but they obviously do love each other unconditionally, but he sort of felt one way and she felt the other back in the early days. The first mention of Victor's infamous medical dictionary is brought up as he panics about a lesion, although not mentioned whereabouts on him, and he continues to be anxious about his health as he is working on the farm for a fourth day running. And Victor's reeling at why Jean's dog couldn't sniff out the spot on him and whether it was infectious or not. We are told that Victor can sort of breathe a sigh of relief after recent test results relating to his back end were given the all clear. So, interesting, this storytelling from Series 6, Tales of Terror, is brought in at this stage. And in the book, the reason for his bowel issues did relate to some black pudding Jean had gifted. On the farm, a postman calls out to Victor from afar, asking if he's having fun. Again, much like in Wisdom, spells it out to Victor. Well, almost spells it out, but slight difference in ridicule was the postie says, "You can't be that daft." The others twigged it in 5 minutes, where in Wisdom, I think they say it was 3 days. But we're back at the Melger's house. Margaret is in a bit of a dreary mood after having a day of it. She's recalling in her mind of Victor asking her to take a look at this lesion, which we come to learn was placed in a more intimate area of his body, shall we say. Just to take a closer look and to ensure of a more effective lighting, she took him into the front room and she knelt down on a cushion and performed her inspection. And unfortunately, Mrs. Ellsbury from across the way was delivering an Oxfam leaflet and had full sight of this now misunderstood event. Later that day, Margaret was in the post office queue, where her ears pricked at someone saying "weird old sod down the road," whilst expecting to hear of the potential smutty gossip by Mrs. Ellsbury. It was, in fact, about Victor's slow-to-realise purpose of farm work of late. So interesting to hear how Margaret learns of this story. We don't really... Obviously, in Wisdom, I guess, Victor sort of spells out to her why he's been on the farm, I think, from memory, whereas in this book, we're seeing it from her point of view of how she learns about how he's basically been set up. It's firmly in the minds of One Foot fans that Margaret will avoid where possible, and probably out of unconditional love, that she would rather she break the news to Victor about the real reason the farmer has called him in, as she hates to see him anguished and trigger a period of loneliness, as it's spelled out in the book. Whereas, like I said, in Wisdom, I think he managed to put two and two together, doesn't he? Should have done some research there. So Victor arrives, he's now arrived at the doctor's at the last minute. So by the way, yeah, obviously in Wisdom we'd see him full rage coming home from the farm, but he's now at the doctor's. As a last minute cancellation meant he can be seen, and he's not at all keen that the foreign exchange medical student sitting in on the exam. All is basically okay, but to be on the safe side, Victor's referred to a urologist, and the entire appointment sees Victor completely put off by the student, who has seemingly drawn a picture of Victor using his thumb to eye at Victor's private area, and even more bizarre to Victor, using a multicoloured pen. When Victor arrives home, he's recounting the story to Margaret, who doesn't quite believe what she is hearing, when Victor's adamant the student had drawn a face at the end of Victor's anatomy. So yeah, at Riverbank, and Victor's recounting the disbelief of his GP visit, basically just dwelling on the student element of the appointment, and Margaret disregards it as ever as Victor and his paranoia. At this stage, Margaret does actually break the news to Victor that he's been used as a scarecrow this whole time, after overhearing the postie at the post office speak of the interaction with Victor earlier. Suddenly the phone rings. It's basically the news that Auntie Ursula has died. I'm pretty sure she's Cousin Ursula in the TV series. But Auntie Ursula's died. So the cause of her death was, again, this fantastic story, fantastic gag, really, but a really unfortunate turn of events. Very comical, but really bizarre. Nothing new, but I have to go over it again. The cause of her death was struck by lightning, basically. Not at the end of Teleaddicts, as mentioned in Wisdom. There's a lot of wisdom storytelling in this first chapter, as you'll have gathered. So yeah, not struck by lightning at the end of Teleaddicts. Actually a more popular reference in that she was struck by lightning at the end of The Hairy Bikers, or actually in the middle of The Hairy Bikers. I made a note, it sounded funny how it was written, the fact that she died in the middle of The Hairy Bikers. In came the lightning, and that was that. Found by a neighbour with an egg frying on her forehead. Poor woman. The Meldrews quickly realise that they'll be responsible for clearing Auntie Ursula's house. Interesting to know that, unlike in the episode of Wisdom, we learn where Ursula lives, roughly somewhere in Yorkshire. Quite a drive from where they live in the Bournemouth region. But actually, I'm quite adamant they don't live in Bournemouth. It will be Southeast London. That's where I think and they live. And the chapter ends with the realisation that they'll have to deal with you-know-who. Yes, Edwin. So I've skimmed over chapter one for you, just to summarise. Victor, you know, he's in work. He's been done up like a kipper because of the nature of the job. Gene Wallboys has got a pen friend in a chap called Chesney. And the Meldrews went up for a lovely romantic anniversary meal, which did end in a little bit of disaster. But the next chapter is The Death of Truth. So we open up with an immediate reintroduction, if you like, to Patrick and Pippa. Patrick apparently won over Pippa in his quest to move on from Riverbank after an apparent 3 years of living there. So it's good to know the timelines in that regard. So I suppose if the timeline of this book is to lie parallel to the series, then I suppose one would have to assume this is the equivalent of Series 5, allowing for a series per year in the universe of the Meldrews, Trenches, Wallboys, Mr. Swaney's, etc. So the story is summarising Patrick's prior experiences with Victor, being frog-marched into Victor's bedroom and the disappearance of the ginseng capsules, which were later turned up in Victor's arse, and perplexed that the Meldrews would think nothing of a house full of garden gnomes and the smuggling of a snake on a plane. Interestingly enough, it's made quite clear that these misdemeanors have been explained to Patrick, but he won't have any of it. He thinks Victor is a sociopath. I think Patrick's a sociopath, maybe even a psychopath, with the machine gunning in Who's Listening. Victor being by his side in the black, the man in the long black coat, and saving his life in Wisdom of the Witch. You mean, come on, like, surely that is enough to forgive those prior misdemeanors. But anyway. So the Trenches are signed up to the estate agents, Marsh and Barber. And there's a mid-50s estate agent called Derek, clearly described as the modern stereotypical Essex type, with an irritating, upbeat persona whose catchphrase is, "No problem." I don't know if Essex people are known to be saying that, but after every other sentence, he'd say, "No problem." And he's advised the Trenches that they must legally disclose any factors that might have an adverse effect on the sale of the house. Things such as outstanding planning issues, probable conflicts in the area, and no particular neighbourly feuds. So the Trenches look at one another and politely smile this off. I mean, you've got to, haven't you? You have to just, it's all perception. It's all, everything can be interpreted differently, I suppose. They could say, no, he's an absolutely lovely guy. No problems to the contrary of whatever you might have heard. But as the Trenches have their sights firmly on a Grade 2 listed house, their luck was in, as a Mr. Hithercroft, who had expressed an interest in the Trenches house after visiting, had written to them to arrange a return inspect more closely. Given this is a modern tale of one foot, with a whole manner of modern ways of the modern world, writing a letter to look around at home seems a bit backwards to me, but some people have their ways and don't like to change their ways, I suppose. On the topic of letters, an excitable Pippa reads out the letter from Mr. Hithercroft. Very, very much warm champagne, but I'm going to read out word for word what is in the letter. "Thank you for showing me round your beautiful home on Thursday. It is a truly delightful property, and I would love to arrange a return visit to inspect it more closely. You will not be surprised to learn I am of a generation that has yet to embrace the smartphone or the modern convention of digital cameras. However, I possess an excellent Roliflex SL35, still in perfect working order, and I trust you would have no objection were I to bring this along when I next call, as I am keen to take some photographs of you in the nude. So, yeah, it's slightly updated version of what's in Warm Champagne. Plus, it makes sense why he would write a letter. Patrick's infamous moustachist reference. Pippa had taken a dim view of this, and of course, since his promotion at work, which has come equipped with a secretary, he's doing rather well for himself. And again, all taken from wisdom. Pippa is unsubtly jealous about this. And we move on to the Meldrews once more. Victor's referral to see urologists saw him receive a quick turnaround in an appointment for June the 1st specifically. This panicked Victor, so it was unusually prompt by the NHS. So it's obviously had the... It's typical Victor, isn't it? He'd moan if it was a 6, 7, 8 month wait, but he gets, you know, an appointment at a quick turnaround and he's panicking, which, to be fair, most of us, perhaps if we think about it, maybe we would read into it. So Victor, at the hospital, he's left waiting on a hospital bed trolley in a grubby old area of the hospital building near some smokers from outside. He is seen too briefly by the alleged specialist, who Victor mistaken as this Dr. Huffenfer. Huffenfeffer. David doesn't make it easy sometimes, does he? He was preparing Victor for surgery, and much to Victor's surprise, he wasn't told of such a thing, shaving his private area in preparation for an operation. The apparent assistant prepping Victor is called Brad, and just like in I Retire to Bedlam, he is merely but a patient of the hospital, and the dialogue is similar to the interaction in Bedlam. Slightly different, speaks about how it cost him 50 lunar K as opposed to lunar dollars, that you couldn't get a bucket of Buzz Aldrin's piss for that now. So that all plays out as a calming nurse comes to take Brad away, except he's not called Brad, he's called Dennis, not Mr. Brocklebank. Calls himself Brad, he's actually called Dennis. And we now turn our attention back to Patrick, who's out for lunch with his work colleagues. By the way, we have a bit more of an insight into what Patrick actually does for a living. He is now a senior creative strategist for digital outreach, which is tasked with the development of day-to-day content analysis and optimizing goals for a more streamlined approach to client procurement across interrelated web platforms. Quite the mouthful. Patrick and his PA are out for lunch. The PA is described as mature for her years in mind and body. Red-headed, bright saucer eyes and a retrousse nose to the rich, flexible lips. Very detailed by David. I can really, although we see what she looks like in Wisdom of the Witch, I actually prefer the sight in my mind of this woman, actually. And she is called Carolyn Walker. I don't think the name suits the description of this apparent beauty. I don't know. It's not a disrespect to the name Carolyn or Walker, although it is a disrespect. I just don't think that name matched up very well. And she's basically announced to Patrick that she's fooled her psychotic, cheating lover, that she's having an affair with Patrick, and that he's out to kill him, basically. And I can't remember in Wisdom if Melvin was a cheat himself, other than that he was just someone who didn't pay much attention to her, that she had needs. But in this, he seemingly is someone who is a cheat himself. So, yeah, that's a bit of a devastating blow to Patrick. We cut to outside of the Meldrews, where Pippa's dropping off a large cactus to hand over to Margaret. And she places this in the corner of the kitchen, where Victor's slippers are now enclosed behind the plants. Margaret is quite glum, as detected by Pippa, as she's followed up the man from the sweet shop's prediction about Victor's imminent demise. So obviously, we spoke earlier about when they're out for an anniversary meal, she visited this witch. Yeah, it was all doom and gloom for poor Victor, and that he should basically avoid long journeys. And the build-up to this reveal by Margaret was funny, as she said the sweet shop man said he couldn't initially talk as he was busy ordering some Belgian truffles and was sacrificed to go and get back to her, which I thought was very, very funny. But when Margaret persisted and demanded he find time for her, he said he'd see what he could do with a mummified frog, and thereon explained in more detail to Margaret of Victor's eerie future that lies ahead. Pippa mentions using eBay to find a christening present for their niece. So her sister's daughter, no doubt. Did we know she had a sister in the TV series? Anyway, her sister is mad keen on vintage toys. And apparently Pippa previously bought a Victorian's doll's house made in South Korea, which Patrick sardonically suggested they should keep it and stick a few children up the chimney. Visual git. Margaret talks of her dread of Victor travelling to Yorkshire just to clear out Aunt Ursula's house. Victor is back to seeing his consultant, who gives him the all clear. So Victor's very relieved. However, his mood is lowered when he finds himself arrested half an hour later in the middle of the hospital car park. Now, the following part of this story is absolutely glorious. It's quite graphic. And I instantly recognise this from the One Foot in the Grave stage play script that I was very fortunate enough to have a copy of. I know I just name dropped there, but I was surprised to see this in the book. So the story goes, Victor was approached by a man in a fancy dress nurse's uniform, obviously outside the hospital, holding a yellow bucket with a slit on the top, clearly a fundraiser, specifically for money to be raised for IVF treatment. Now, Victor is assuming this is a woman, despite the 6-foot-tall bearded bloke being described as, you know, he's being quite a unit of a man. I think he doesn't want to assume it's a man in case he gets into trouble with, you know, what it can be like in this day and age, is the message I'm reading here. And Margaret, by the way, cannot fathom why Victor would think this was a woman, as she's very much spelling out how obvious the distinction between what men and women look like. And Victor said he didn't want to get himself into any trouble. So this is Victor telling the story to Margaret, by the way. So I'll be mentioning Margaret's name. So she's learning this for the first time. So Victor said he didn't want to get himself in any trouble. So he went along with this man, clearly a man, dressed as a woman and treated as a woman, because he says, you know, you get into all sorts of trouble. So interesting political dilemma there. And I'm glad that this is addressed in this book, in this moment anyway. But suffice to say, Victor's representing those who fear the big backlash to assuming wrongly. Margaret is representing the common sense approach, I suppose. The man dressed for fun as a woman asked Victor if he'd like to donate to the cause, which Victor's starting to completely misunderstand. Keyword donate. And to confuse things further, he's told that there's a bank around the corner if that helps to contribute. So Victor finds an NHS fan with IVF written on the side, and he spots another yellow bucket, and well, let's say the rest is history. So there's a bit of back and forth with Margaret, and it's absolutely brilliant. You could just picture the disdain look on her face, and it even spells out one of her frustrated roar sounds when it went in such disbelief. God only knows how this would have looked on stage or how it would have been played out. This is apparently the talk of the town, and Margaret is understandably embarrassed as she goes about her business with the local community. So, yeah, basically, in a nutshell, Victor has basically masturbated into a yellow bucket, thinking that's what they meant by donation. And the mix-up with the word bank, I mean, I'm spoon-feeding you here, literally. So, poor Victor. Poor colleagues of that department who would have walked in to Victor, pleasured himself, I suppose. Anyway, a little bit later into this scene, Victor notices that the cactus I mentioned earlier wonders where his slippers are. And there's nothing more on that for now, but it is twice referenced. So after the talk of a forthcoming storm, which they've named Storm Benjamin, very briefly named Storm Benjamin before being hastily cancelled for being anti-Semitic. So they renamed it to Storm Charlie. Therefore, Victor postpones his trip to the north. I think this is highlighting how fragile society can get, this sort of thing, to associate one thing with a completely irrelevant thing altogether. It's at this point, like at the very beginning of this book, for a second time, we come to the status of this part of the story, where somewhere in the southeast, RAF fighter jets were being scrambled, while the Prime Minister chaired an emergency meeting of the Cobra Committee, and the nation rejoiced. We'll call that the cryptic intervention of the story as we go, because that will be brought to the surface every so often. Meanwhile, the mail just received a letter from the solicitors, which is taken straight from, I believe, Beware the Tricks on the Roof, where there's an inventory list of items not covered by the will. One of which is, you guessed it, one cot, rear leg slightly damaged. And Margaret wants to retrieve this for Pippa's niece this time. Of course, not her own, like in that particular episode of the TV series. Moving swiftly on, the Meldrews are in town meeting Mrs. Warboys for coffee, much to Victor's dissatisfaction. Jean goes off on a gossiping tangent and reels off a couple of tales she's heard within the community, including a Mr. Spiller, who used to live around the corner from the Meldrews' old house, who's dating a woman from the gasworks and somehow got up there without anyone knowing, but one day dropped his binoculars, which is how he found out. That's all we know of this spurious bit of gossip, and to me it doesn't make much sense. He climbed up a gasworks building, then dropped his binoculars in the back garden, and that's how she found out what. I was a bit unsure of that line. But then Jean actually speaks about how he hasn't been right since falling down some stairs and having to have his whole arm in plaster, and when it was removed, his arm was missing. That anecdote, I believe, Beast in the Cage. I think it's referenced by Mark in another episode, actually, when on the telephone, something about playing snooker with a prosthetic. I believe that's in Pit and the Pendulum episode. I could be wrong. So Gene also said this: Mr. Spinner cracked his head open when changing a light bulb, to which Victor replied, "You can't change a light bulb with one arm," with Gene responding, "You can if you still got the receipt." So that's a one for the Algarve. Or possibly Beast in a Cage one-liner. My mind is a bit squiffy on that one. Anyway, Victor's had enough of this gossip, like he does throughout the series, and escapes to use the toilet. It was at this time Margaret inquires about Chesney. Any Chesney updates? Jean states things are not looking good, especially since some awful governor has been re-elected to show he's tough on crime. Some new evidence might have been found to support Chesney, but it's still looking doubtful. Chesney, however, is grateful for Jean's support and gets much comfort and joy in knowing someone believes of his innocence, and such comfort is sought by the very photo he has on his wall of his cell. To Margaret's amazement, Jean actually sent a photo of Margaret instead of her, as she takes a dig at her age and how there's a lovely photo of Margaret from last Christmas in which she cropped out Victor. Margaret is obviously flabbergasted and probably horrified by this, like you would. Such a Jean thing to do. But also, if she has any hope of meeting him, how on earth is she going to explain that? It's actually more than thoughtful of Jean to show care into this, you know, inmate who's been found guilty of homicide, and she's, you know, got a lot of belief in him. So that shows that particular caring side to Jean. Meanwhile, Patrick is seeing off the remainder of his panic attack at the ludicrous lie his assistant had told her psycho boyfriend. And Pippa, naturally showing zero empathy for his predicament, they receive a phone call from Derek at the Marsh and Barbara estate agents. It's good news. Mr. and Mrs. McVitie are looking for a quick sale. Cash buyers, no chain. Which means Patrick had to spruce up the garden and house and appreciate the appointment of this house theme was during a relatively quiet period, aka apparently not when Mrs. Skimpson's bagpipe practice was occurring, or the screaming kids at number 9 coming home from school. So a nice little mention of Mrs. Skimpson there. I like that. So Victor and Margaret, they were travelling home by bus from town, to which they could hear some commotion at the other end, as a young woman and a man having a bit of a barney of sorts. And when Victor and Margaret got off at the Wood Green Common, they found the gentleman in question beside them. It was at this moment the man recognised Victor and Margaret. He was a Gregory Birchall, someone they knew from the old days, although Victor's memory somewhat faded regarding this. I'm actually unsure if this Gregory recognised Victor and Margaret first or vice versa. It's not that clear, other than you get Gregory's response of, oh, you know, it's been how many years? You know, you're both looking well. So they hit it off quite quickly, really, considering how long they've not, you know, seen one another as a three. Margaret asks what the argument on the bus was about with this young woman. It's because, quite simply, he offered up his seat, but Gregory was somewhat spiritual in his very recent confrontation, saying that young women of today are like how they used to be, politically speaking, wanting to make changes to social attitudes, etc. So the joke from here on out was Gregory saying he's in the independent film game, covering global conspiracies and other repressive Western policies of Western puppet regime, shall we say, and he has a follow-up to his last book, Inside the Lying Machine. It explains why, albeit briefly and especially cryptic, to present as a moving target, but he couldn't go into detail why. So when Victor and Margaret look around in paranoid fashion and then turn back, Gregory's actually gone as quick as a flash. So he really does feel like he's a moving target. From afar, Margaret could actually spot a man and a woman described as shady looking. The man's attire consisted of a long black coat, note the Christmas special by the same name, polo neck sweater, skin tight gloves, and a shaved head, and a face that showed a tragic dental history. The woman was tall and stiff in a short leather jacket. She had blonde hair and legs not for the faint hearted. Both of them with collars turned up, all very sinister it seemed. Margaret pulled Victor's arm and encouraged them to get the hell out of there. So, on to Mr. and Mrs. McVitie, described as the very essence of nice. By the way, they're not called Derek and Betty, but Tony and Betty. I don't know why Derek is now Tony. I'm not too sure on the name change. I think there was a Derek mentioned earlier. Perhaps that's the reason. They're young and keen, full of energy, and they are viewing number 18 Riverbank, which I found semi-interesting given house numbers side by side are usually every other number, odd or even. The McVitties, ever the complimentary pair of the Trenchers' house, request their 10-year-old son called Josh also looks around, to which the Trenchers oblige. The 10-year-old identifies a stain around the kitchen sink plug hole. Pippa's quick to cover this up by stating this was due to a bit of turmeric from the other night, and they tried to put some Domestos down, but at this point Josh cuts in with, maybe you should try again, followed by once more into the bleach, which brings out a bit of a guffaw of laughter from his parents. And in the book, Pippa responds with, oh, very good, and Patrick literally, I don't think he says this out loud, but it's spelt out as WTF. I think you all know what that means. So some modern abbreviation speak there. And Mrs. McVitty, while stabbing her eye, apologising as they get this all the time, stating he's a comedian, with Pippa responding, well, he certainly is for 10 years old. But Mrs. McVitty, the mum, replies, no, he really is a stand-up comic. It's what he does in his spare time. And when Pippa responded with, you're joking, Josh replied with, that's the general idea, whilst running his finger along a Venetian blind. This kid is reminding me of the brat in Fawlty Towers for some reason. You know, the one who wants Mickey Mouse-shaped chips or salad cream. That guy. Don't know why, just that's the first person that came to my mind. He's also mocking Patrick's moustache, asking if he's been eating Marmite, and also looking like Hitler's gone wrong. Which, to be fair, he isn't wrong. That moustache does not suit Patrick Angus Deaton in general. And during the tour of the house, there's a lot of bashing and thrashing going on at the back door, much to the embarrassment and awkwardness for the Trenches. This is not the right time for any cock-ups during an almost complete house sale. After Patrick tries to cover this up as a bit of bad weather, we hear a voice call out Patrick's name. Of course, the fear is Melvin's caught up with Patrick and is paying a visit. And as Patrick opens the back door, which was barely on its hinges, it was not Melvin. It was, in fact, a cow with the delivery driver, so to speak, next to it. Much confusion for Patrick and a lot of anger when he learns it's been sent by a male Jew, as outlined on the delivery docket. The McVitie's son Josh is terrified of cows, apparently. Not so cocky now, is he? And they make a very quick escape. Obviously, in the TV episode, it's a completely different family and a different reason why a child in that episode is traumatised by one of Victor's homemade cuddly toys, if I remember correctly. And we cut to Victor and Margaret. Margaret is a little bit bewildered. Victor can't understand why she didn't tell them it was coming, but Margaret wanted to surprise them. This is reminiscent of Tom and Croker's wine fiasco, but in reverse. It becomes clear that lot 362 for a cot was a typo, but the item definitely had one bad leg. That night, with Victor fast asleep, Margaret was wide awake with two thoughts. One of them was of Gregory, and what may have happened to him doesn't bear thinking about. And the other was an email from Chesney on her laptop, nosing at Jean's emails. Interesting to see that Margaret can be just as nosy as Jean Warboys. But it's just Chesney speaking about some new evidence his lawyer has possession of, and how looking at the photo of Jean gives him hope, and how he sees her as his spiritual mother. The chapter ends there, really, with Margaret possibly shedding a tear, but it reads as her having hay fever. That excuse we use when we're covering up the fact we're quite over-emotional about something that we can't quite admit. We're now at chapter 3, simply titled Edwin. We seem to be heading back in time now to series 2 of the series. Specifically, we are put her living in the tomb in this opening chapter, because Margaret's up a step ladder, putting the final touches to the new wallpaper as Victor's supposed to be holding the ladder. But all the while, distracting himself with a phone call, he's on hold to the dry cleaners, getting ever frustrated with the whole music, the automated IVR message about various options. He mocks the situation in hand like he does throughout the TV series. Just from the top of my head, apart from the laundry service call in the Living in the Tomb episode, he does the same in Starbound when unintentionally creating an advert for false limb prosthetics and the like. I actually can't think of any more, but you get my drift. Anyway, in this chapter, to mock the constant hold music and automated IVR messages, he plays out a routine of owning a chip shop. Happy Haddock Chip Shop for all your fish and chip solutions, he says. And says, press option 1 if you're calling about boning your gurnet, amongst other sardonic options he calls out. And I love the call back to gurnet. I think he mentions that in series 6, doesn't he? I'm sure that's in the Executioner song. After Victor gets through to a Mavis, the dry cleaners, but by the same name actually in the series episode, he loses his mind, as she was the particular call agent he'd already spoken to. Incidentally, I can't remember if I spoke about this in that particular episode on the podcast, we put her living in the tomb, but cool. How big is this laundry company that there'd be like a call operator and a hold option switchboard? It just seems like even an industrial size massive laundrette would still only have one line, but let's not split hairs. Anyway, his complaint is about the note left on the tag of one of the coat hangers, referencing the garment having stains on and an unusually resilient nature. Victor closes the call with a great sarcastic and crudish one line about him having to jet wash his nose before he blows it, and then he hangs up. So it's more or less exactly how it's played in that particular episode, as you all know. The storylines of what we know are mashed up with other episodes we come to know and love. Margaret talks about a meal she and Pip have set up for Patrick and Victor by way of peace talks, which I think happens in Hole in the Sky Series 5. But in this scenario, this is the sort of last chance to make friends before Patrick and Pippa move out of the area. It turns out Margaret's into yoga and is offering to drop Victor off at the restaurant so he can enjoy a drink. Victor says he's surprised the young couple ended up buying the Trench's house. It's obviously referring to the McVitties. So all was forgiven with the cow. And they saw the funny side of it, apparently. We then go through that rather ludicrous but funny note left by the woman in the hardware shop who had written down a list of paints on the back of her late husband's suicide note. So again, it's just replaying that hilarious scene. Much of the follow-up to the meal is played out, again, exactly how it is in the episode and as we know it. Then, of course, all the wallpapers come off, no thanks to a Sid. So, obviously, Margaret, absolutely bewildered that Victor would rely on someone called Sid to do the decorating, that Victor had no real way of cancelling the job directly. I thought it was interesting that the book references Victor only knows Sid by way of having a drink with him now and again. I know this is mentioned in the TV episode, but it's nice to know he does actually have mates he can drink with. He's not some loner. I don't like to think Victor's on... I know he's obviously got old school friends that unfortunately never actually met any of them for the reunion in Things Aren't Simple Anymore. And I know he's had a whinge about why do people just want to meet up, but you know, you still want him to have a bit of a social life, don't you? And I'm glad there's such a person as Sid in this universe. A little bit further forward in time, not too far ahead, the introduction of the what we think is the house removal men, who are actually obviously the clearance company. They've turned up at the Meldrews whilst Victor is dashing around, ready to go out. He's putting the bins out around the back, and he obviously invites them in. You know, they'd be forgiven, actually, that they're thinking that they're there to clear the house out. Because of the storyline of the wallpaper coming off through Victor's mate Sid, or someone who Sid knows, that storyline is mashed together with Wisdom of the Witch. So you've got We're Put a Living in the Team and the Wisdom of the Witch be merged together here for this part of the storyline. Yeah, so those removal men, I've seen all of the Meldrews' furniture stacked up against the wall because of the recent decorating, and they're naturally, they think they're there to do a job. So of course, yeah, he sends them round next door saying, you know, it's next door you want, it's not us. Patrick and Victor are out in town for the same reasons, bit of sustenance shopping for the trip ahead. Obviously, Victor's got a long trip to Yorkshire to clear out Ursula's house. Patrick is out and about because I think they're waiting to move. They're waiting for the removal men and he's getting itchy feet. So Pippa's sent him on his way just to basically kill time in this part of the story. And yeah, they meet each other in the multi-story car park. And we are, you know, introduced shortly to Melvin. I'm not going to, again, I know I have so far sort of described what's been going on, even though you know from the series how things play out. I'll somewhat skip the bit where Patrick and Victor awkwardly come face to face with one another, by the way, which is after their awkward meal. Again, that's the awkward meal was from series 6, where they're to share a sausage. It's all intertwined into this particular part of the novel. And Victor has to go back and get, again, I'm doing what I said I wouldn't. So you know how it plays out. Unfortunately, this Melvin comes face to face with Patrick. The dialogue from Melvin is a little bit stronger for the book compared to, I don't remember in the TV series him saying this, so he rather menacingly goes up to Patrick and he says, "So you and my young lady, is that right? Throwing your dick around in the supplies cupboard at work. A man could have a very nasty accident with a staple gun." Nice little modern take on that, I suppose. I say modern in the sense that probably that sort of language would be more likely used today versus early mid-90s, maybe. The other modern take of this is that Melvin grabs Patrick's smartphone and bins it, because obviously phones can be tracked. Back then, you very unlikely would have had a mobile phone. Even if you did, it's probably not trackable. So whilst Patrick is unfortunately kidnapped, while Victor is collecting his pot of scotch, whatever it is he left at the supermarket, the women, Pippa and Margaret, they're obviously at the Trench's new home while they wait for the alleged removal men to turn up. We actually finally learn where they live. They actually moved to a place called Thruxton, which is in Hampshire. Real place, of course. Victor is more than on his merry way now. In the episode, I believe, because it's a very snowy, he's caught up in a blizzard and he's forced off the road. It's a little bit different how this one's played out. He's forced to swerve at the last minute as an old lady on a push bike is cycling in the opposite direction. As he passes her, she actually calls him a bastard, which I did laugh at. And as Victor surveys the damage to his car and where he's at, he curses and he says shit, which I don't know if Victor's ever said shit before. Has he ever said shit before? If he has, I'm not too sure in what context. And when Patrick and Victor become acquainted once again, we have a bit more dialogue between the pair compared to the TV episode. Patrick saying he'd wish Victor had opened the boot back in the car park, but since Victor didn't want to bugger about with a dodgy boot, he decided not to put the eggs in there. Scene switches back to Pippa and Patrick's new house, who are by now worrying where Patrick is. Pippa begins to speculate why he's not being in touch, and obviously I haven't touched upon it since reviewing this book, but she has been giving him quite a hard time about the secretary, about the Karenin woman. So maybe she's starting to believe that this mad boyfriend is baying for Patrick. But Patrick does actually check in with Pippa to relieve her of any further worry and explain about this Melvin character. As opposed in the actual TV episode, I believe he rings via his workplace and they get them to pass on the message to Pippa. He is a little hesitant to ring the police though, much to Pippa's anguish and worry, however Pippa did in fact call the police directly. Now, Tunstall and Gridley, they turn up at the Trench's new place with a £850 addressed to Margaret though, which after racking her brains reveals to Pippa what she believes has happened. Cut back to Patrick and Victor who are trying to settle in for the night. Something occurred to me. I know this, I've speculated how Victor and Margaret afford to live off like one pension and one part-time job, with Margaret being at the florist part-time. It's not impossible, but they must be quite skint. But do we think Urs left her house to them in the will? I know they left her some items in that inventory list, but I wonder if that house was just passed down to Margaret because Urs had no one else to pass it on to. So they probably were quite sorted for that, for their final years together. Obviously the lads are getting a bit sozzled as they settle in for the night. The topic of Patrick's arachnophobia has been discussed. Again, I'm not going to go over that part at this moment in time. What I find quite amusing was the picture painted by Remick on how the phone signal was terrible and the only way for them to use a phone was to stick half their body out of the window to make calls. And with the gale force winds and a storm on the way, it pictured a very funny scene in my head as they would casually make the odd phone call back home. So once Victor learns of the humongous cock-up caused by him, obviously we have the interaction with Patrick, learning what's really happened with the removal men. It's a little bit of deviation here, part of the story where Victor's car, which has now broken down not far from Ursula's, the discovery of the mechanics version of Guy Meo, Thou Great Redeemer, Bread of Heaven song. It was actually a rendition performed by the mechanics who have a name. They are H.L. Foskett Auto Repairs and Body Shop. So a nice little nod to the great one-off character by Brian Murphy. Pretty cool that we're a step closer into learning of his possible Christian name. I'm not saying Mr. Foskett is a car mechanic by any means, but is there a clue that his Christian name began with an H? A middle name L. I mean, what could the H stand for, I wonder? Anyway, to fit in modern times, the song was apparently uploaded to YouTube and it went viral. So when Victor's car was rescued down the road from Mercedes, the mechanics had recognised the name and began humming the tune. And apparently even Victor thought to himself that he found himself humming to it recently. Victor stays away from Patrick, given the recent troubles. Patrick had noticed something scuttering away beneath a wig. Pippa and Margaret then turn up after Patrick's car being found abandoned on a motorway. Therefore, Patrick and Pippa left late that night and stayed at a nearby hotel called The Strangest Rest. I think you One Foot fans will know where that name is from, which will probably extract a lot of sadness from you. Again, like in the episode, Patrick and Pippa unknowingly book into a sex hotel or whatever swinging type peep show this was. And when Patrick became aware of what was going on when being dragged into the two-way mirror room, whilst collecting some ice for the champagne, they both scarpered. The seven bedrooms in Ursa's house are described in part as smelling like boiled cabbage. Victor's binned several pairs of pyjamas over the years when arriving back home after staying at Ursa's because of this. When they arrive back at Ursa's place, they're offered the room that apparently great auntie Gertie used to live in. So, of course, in Broken Reflection, an auntie Gertie was referenced by Alfred, Victor's brother, who'd apparently escaped. Some listeners speculated, actually, to me that if he meant a person or an animal with a peculiar pet name who had escaped. But in the book, it's definitely a human. The book also indicates great auntie Gertie used to live in Ursus' house before they got a court order. I'm just trying to think what that could mean, obviously, or you can have a guess. With finger marks down the wall being filled in, that was mentioned, and bars being taken off the window. It sounds awfully dark, and that poor auntie Gertie had probably gone insane. So it sounds like Victor was concerned they'd be staying in that room due to the history of who stayed there and the literal marks that were left behind. There's a nice little callback, actually, to Timeless Time, when Victor's described as wiping his nose on the pillowcase of the bed he's lying in, and Margaret telling him about the hotel Patrick and Pip had checked into. And when the trenches are getting ready for bed, Patrick realised his toiletry bag must be in the car, so Pippa goes off to retrieve it. And when she's gone, Patrick's getting ready for bed, he's fluffing up the pillows before, shock horror, something much worse than a big hairy spider turns up and confronts Patrick out of nowhere. Yes, obviously, it's Melvin. So it's Patrick is very much shitting himself, repeatedly calling out, "Oh my God." I forgot to say, the phrase, "Oh my God," really does wind up Melvin. It winds him up because that's not going to save you, mate. Why do you keep saying, "Oh my God"? And actually, Melvin uses the phrase, "Can you give that bollocks a rest?" before interrupting himself, asking if Patrick could smell boiled cabbage, which I thought was quite amusing. Amongst his anger and rage, he's going, "Oh, can you smell boiled cabbage?" So coming at Patrick with a harpoon, Patrick is attacked him, mostly in the dark, on this four-poster bed. But actually, the hero of the hour wasn't Victor in this version of events. He and Margaret were, of course, concerned by the racket that they could hear. They assumed they were just arguing quite violently. But the hero of the hour, after returning from the car with the toiletry bag, was in fact Pippa, who lobbed the bag towards Melvin, missing him by quite some distance, might I add. It hit the roof of the bed and all of its contents fell onto Melvin's face, which included, from the top of the four-poster bed, Edwin. He clung onto Melvin's face, which meant Melvin frantically trying to fight it off, struggling and in obvious pain, made his way to the window that was open, which, by the way, Patrick had been plumping dusty cushions out of, had fallen out onto the conservatory glass roof. And Edwin is described as covering the entirety of Melvin's face from forehead to neck. A huge tarantula, obviously. It made its way over the broken glass debris into its glass cage. And that brought about the end of the Edwin chapter. So there was some fun to be had there with intertwining different episodes. We have put A Living in the Tomb, obviously, Wisdom of the Witch, a little bit of Broken Reflection. And it takes us on to chapter 4, entitled Yakety Sax and Beyond the Infinite. With an opening monologue about the infinite universe and how its expiry was practically imminent, the opening to this chapter actually concludes what happened to Melvin. As the police are gathering statements from Victor, we learn Melvin received 15 years for his shenanigans. And once again, David's written in the Prime Minister chair in a Cobra meeting whilst the nation yet again rejoices. But it all seems rather ominous still. Still don't quite know what that message means at this stage. I think it's the third time that's mentioned. All out of context as well. We're also still in Yorkshire. Well, Victor is. Margaret needs to head back down south as the florists require her assistance with some big floral displays. Victor's still in Yorkshire. Margaret is still there, but she is due to head back home, should I say. Victor went to collect some post from down the lane in Ursula's post box. All the while, Margaret spotted a neighbour making quite the racket, installing some fencing for his chickens and ducks between two sheds that she swears were a bit closer to the house than they used to be. Anyway, sidetracked as she was, her phone rang. Not recognising the voice straight away, it was Gregory. If you remember Gregory from the second chapter, the one they bumped into and recognised each other from. The one who works in film, creating documentaries, who some would describe as a conspiracy theorist. He found out where Margaret was by asking one of her colleagues at the florist, Meg, I can presume. Gregory's trying to say that he's once again been caught up in some near misses where his life was concerned, but also to apologise for the swift exit from the other day. He said he was doing a documentary and he and his film crew were being chased and ended up crashing. His cameraman actually died. And the footage of what we discovered was swiftly removed from YouTube, apparently. Very convenient. Someone out there is very fair of what Gregory's discovered. And the other reason for the call was for an invite of Victor and Margaret to have dinner at his hotel by the end of the week, as he's going to be out of town next week. And Margaret says that Victor's staying up in Yorkshire to sort out her aunt's house, but rather than Gregory getting the hint, he says to Margaret, "But you'll be around." With a bit of hesitancy, Margaret says she's not sure what her plans are yet and doesn't really get to finish her sentence before Gregory says to think about it, as she has his number now. I don't know what you're thinking, but I'm instantly picturing Ben in warm champagne at this moment. This follows with Victor's little mission in retrieving Ursa's mail in what I think is one of those external post boxes at the bottom of the lane. His first attempt caused much pain and aggro, as inside the box was a wasp nest. So he could, however, identify one white parcel. And after being stung and going through that particular palaver, he ran back home half naked after undressing himself at the post box, bathed his sting wounds and returned in more appropriate attire with thick gardening gloves. And he eventually retrieved the parcel, which had no address on it. And all that was written was, "Warning, this post box is full of wasps." And underneath, "We'll leave all future mail in a black bin liner behind Hawthorn Bush, postie." As Victor made his way back to the house, he was surprised to see Margaret still present. She was supposed to leave by 2 p.m. that day, and it was well past this time, and she was inspecting some plans of Ursula's house. This was sparked by the neighbour building a fence for his chickens and ducks earlier on, and she could see that according to the plans, the sheds and fencing was a good 10 yards onto Ursula's land. Victor doesn't really seem at all fazed with this, although you can imagine if it was his house, he would be. This seems like, yeah, a bit of a role reversal here. Victor would usually be the one to kick up a fuss about this kind of thing. You've only got to look at Mr. Swaney and his fencing ways, if you like. Modifying the fence, putting an entry point into Victor's garden every other series. Margaret is sort of showcasing a bit of sexism, shall I say, as she insists Victor needs to speak to this neighbour about it, who's called Mr. Sheldrake. Because she has to finally hit the road. Victor's a little concerned at the possibility that this neighbour might have a gun. It's a countryside folk, you just never know. He senses something else is up, but he can't put his finger on it. He thinks the Sheldrake's business is just masking what's really up. So Victor makes his way across the field to speak to the neighbour. Margaret watches on. She can't really make out what's going on, so she does find some binoculars. As she remembered her Uncle Dan having. It's another uncle to be introduced to there. It was quite baffling, but Margaret could apparently see Victor gesturing to the sky and pointing to areas around him, which followed with the pair of them, that's Victor and Mr. Sheldrake, apparently laughing and joking, all very jovial. With a small twist in proceedings, an apparently beautiful woman in her mid-50s, classy-like woman, comes out one of these sheds to greet Victor. She seemed, from Margaret's perspective, very flirty. This woman, Sheldrake's wife, had described as having lovely long hair, lovely olive skin, and just looked the business, really. By this time, Victor and this couple now sat on chairs as Mr. Sheldrake pulls out a bottle of wine. Victor's also handing around the M&Ms, a lovely little Dramatic Fever callback. What's going on here, Margaret's thinking. And is that wine warm champagne, do we think? Things take a twist as the woman begins to choke on the peanuts of the M&M. And much how Victor came to the aid of Isabella in One Foot in the Algarve, he did so for Mr. Sheldrake performing the Heimlich manoeuvre. So as Victor performs the Heimlich manoeuvre, things seem a little bit calmer after the woman had looked like she choked on something, which we know to be M&M, but Margaret wouldn't know from her point of view. She goes to take a quick toilet break, and when she returns, she can actually see Victor over a barrel by this woman. I mean, literally, against the water butt. I see your butt's in a story state. And she was, from Margaret's perspective, she can see this woman with putting Victor over a barrel, unbuttoning his shirt and copping a bit of a feel. It's all very mysterious, but we cut away to being told that Margaret is halfway down the M1, and we learn this is when the accident occurred. Accident, I hear you ask. It's all very vague and cryptic. She was not paying attention as she let her mind wander. Victor was trying to call her repeatedly where the calls were coming through the car stereo. Bit of Bluetooth there, modern times. And one of her mindless, unimportant thoughts were whether there was any fish fingers left at home for tea and that she may need to stock up on the way home. And with this in mind, she answered the call to Victor, who couldn't understand why she avoided his calls. It's obvious by now Margaret is sporting a bit of jealousy about her persona. And Victor explained that Mr. Sheldrake and his wife, Cressida, who were apparently really lovely, will look into the plans, but think Margaret might have been looking at the wrong bits or something. But they would, if they're in the wrong, move back the sheds or look to buy some of the land. Victor explains the choking incident and how Cressida was very helpful in massaging some special gel after, of course, being stung by the wasps earlier. With this innocent explanation, Margaret's still very passive-aggressive like you'd expect her to be, and how we've seen her time and time again in the TV series act like. Much like the earlier Gregory situation with being invited for an evening shindig, Victor says he and Margaret are invited to afternoon tea with the neighbours, but obviously Margaret can't as she'll be back home. So from here, Margaret is settled back home and going to bed. There's talk of dreams and the things we pick up in our psyche. She awakes to the sound of the radio alarm with a news reporter covering the tabloid front pages. And somehow it reminded her of this Gregory Birchall. And what was playing on her mind is the obvious guilt of wanting to meet him at this hotel and imagining Victor in a jeep careering down a dirt track with the local militia squad firing his head. It seems like a jealousy is giving way to guilt and her thoughts on this Cressida woman. On her way to work, all these thoughts were going around her head, and when at the florist, she would more or less unwind and put everything temporarily to bed, but then came the curious case of Mrs. Staveacre. In Yorkshire, Victor is round Cressida and Roger's place for the afternoon, so Roger and Cressida are the couple, live next to Ursula's place. And Victor showed some Islamic pottery, which bores him to tears, apparently, to the point that he's already zoned out after a few minutes into his arrival, and he's caught off guard in being asked where he's from. And at this moment, Roger is chainsawing outside and is accidentally sawn off his foot, much to the shock and horror of Cressida and Victor. We cut back to Margaret reading a local rag, the Herald, no doubt. There's an article about a cruel prank played by presumably youths who have posted ice blocks of urine to a 90-year-old pensioner, Mrs. Kitty Staveacre, who was recovering from a hip hop. The article mentioned it was addressed to number 19, which caught Margaret's attention. She was wondering if this package was sent to 19 Rivers Bank. It wouldn't be much of a shock if this item was not intended for Mrs. Staveacre at all. And there's therefore a call back to one particular incident involving some offensive lyrics in a rap song being one example of how the Meldrews, or Victor more so, had been at war with the neighbours. David has gone to the trouble of writing a very offensive rap song, which I've posted on the Twitter, Instagram. So you can have a little look at that. If you haven't got that, I'll send a picture on email to you of the lyrics. I'm not going to read it out now. But Victor, at the time, so hears this loud music. He'd went out to investigate whilst Margaret looked on, standing in the doorway. And there's an ice cream van parked near Mrs. Aylesbury's. And the music is blaring from this particular vehicle, with the vendor slouched in his seat on a quick break. Victor approached him in true Victor style, confronting the madness of this antisocial behaviour on a Sunday morning as well. With a short argument between Victor and the ice cream van man came the flippant one-liner from the ice cream man, calling out to Victor to stop taking the piss, to which Victor replied, "I'll take the piss as much as I want, when and wherever I want, if it's all the same to you." And from there, the ice cream van man had hatched his idea in calling Victor's non-bluff, shall I say. In other words, took things quite literally, and yes, you can easily guess how poor Mrs. Staveacre ended up with those yellow breeze blocks. Cressida was at the hospital by now, anxiously biting her lip and for some news. A nurse described as Sri Lankan and short, an ideally specialist in knees, approached Cressida, asking if the man with her was her husband. "Good God, no," she says, "this is Mr. Meldrew." She starts explaining why they're at the hospital, and it's totally misleading, because it's not because of Roger. It's because Victor saw what Roger had done, fainted and banged his head on the way down. The nurse is shocked to learn about Roger and his sewn-off limb. Cressida's very flippant about this and dismissed it out of hand. "Oh, it's the second time in 6 months this has happened. But his false leg is so obvious now, she stopped mentioning it." So yeah, fooled twice by Mr. Renwick there. Unfortunately, as Victor awakens, he does not remember who he is once he's come around and is explained what's happened to him, basically. Meanwhile, Margaret's dwelling on recent events up north and particularly insecure about this Cressida woman, as she's about to get her head down for the night. She's also feeling a bit guilty at her last interaction with Victor and how he probably didn't read between the lines. She then started to picture all sorts of things that might have gone wrong since she last spoke to him. Might he have been knocked over by a car or been attacked? She hadn't heard from him. Yet she was also paranoid something might be going on with Victor and Cressida. Surely not. Not our Vic. She decides to phone Victor, but Cressida's on the other end. At this time of night, it's not looking good for Victor. As if Margaret wasn't paranoid enough, this is similar to Affair of the Hollow Lady, actually. However, Cressida's been nice, even if misleading in her opening moments of the phone call. She calls out to Victor to wake up and turn on the bedside lamp. Doesn't look or sound good. You know, he's in hospital, yes, but Margaret doesn't obviously know that at this stage. Thankfully, though, it is quickly explained to Margaret, and he has to stay with Roger and Cressida, as hospitals will only let a patient out on their own who have suffered some form of concussion for the first 24 hours. He's got to be with Roger and Cressida, because patients aren't allowed out of hospitals within the first 24 hours after experiencing some kind of concussion. Margaret was on her way to collect Victor for the following day or so, as Victor was doing the last checks of Ursula's house, ensuring all the windows and doors were shut. Cressida phoned to see if she could post the property plans over about the prior boundaries issue. Victor said just to pop them over before he heads home. It took a few moments to realise this was not the best idea given the previous wasp stinging incident. He noticed she was approaching the postbox before rushing to her aid. Obviously the postbox, I presume, is a lot closer than going to Ursula's house further up the lane. But surely you just go to the house like Victor said. He noticed she was approaching the postbox before rushing to her aid. However, it was too late. One whole arm in that box and she was done for. And in cruel timing, Margaret was pulling up to the driver of Ursula's, where she noticed Cressida unbuttoning her top and undressing herself as Victor was chasing after her. And it's fair to say the trip on the way home was a frosty one. The next incident in the Meldrews' lives is one we're all too familiar with from the series, and it's from Warm Champagne. As Margaret goes off to work, Victor's in the garden when he hears the sound of a car crash. Although in this case, it's not a milk float that's done it. It's a police car chase that had led to this event. And with the street lamp, newly fitted might I add, now crashed through the Meldrews' bedroom window, it was all but impossible to fall asleep. Margaret is in a foul mood still, and Victor obviously none too happy about the latest crap they're dealing with. And for Margaret, it's all the recent stresses with Cressida and her slightly compromised thoughts on this Gregory character. She gets up in the early hours and looks at her internet browsing history. And she has a load of websites to catch up on regarding Gregory and a few of his uploaded videos on YouTube. And she's reading some of the reviews on his books and looking at the work he's been carrying out. And a revelation to this Gregory, as mentioned in Rearranging the Dust, this Gregory is the chap Margaret first very much fancied and failed to locate during a power cut when she ended up with Victor. Margaret is about to switch off the laptop, but a video catches her eye with Gregory in. But to be honest, it's fairly cryptic to me at this point, but Margaret seems to stare in absolute disbelief at the screen, and she isn't so tired anymore. It's footage of American armed forces attacking some Guatemalan village. It made for pretty grim viewing, and Gregory was seen in the thick of it, and not much more is spoken of this. The following day, and Victor sat in his armchair with a screwdriver stood up right between his legs as Margaret looks on bemused. She's off out to see Gregory, but she doesn't inform Victor of this. He's too distracted with fixing the TV, which is typical as the football's on tonight. Victor references he's sarcastically looking forward to returning up there, in air quotes, but it's not specified where. Can only assume Ursula's, which I assume they were done with. Margaret's a little cagey about her plans, but says Victor should stay back because he's bored and anyhow, he can go to watch football at the pub. Victor's local is called the Goats and Compass, and that is where he would plan to watch the game. And Margaret, on the other hand, was by now meeting Gregory in the reception of his hotel. He didn't make much of an effort in dress wear, unlike Margaret, but she was swiftly invited up to eat dinner in his room. Had he known of her calculated reason why she turned up alone, he might not have invited her at all, but he is a man on the continuous run and almost, and is always, at risk of losing his life, hence needing to eat in this room. But the book states that, yes, he probably isn't thinking the same kind of things as Margaret at this point. But back at Riverbank, and as Victor's leaving, through the back entrance, an ambulance has turned up around the front. Dell and Jacinta, the two paramedics, or probably some kind of hospital porter driver workers, were driving through Riverbank only to discover several lampposts have been crashed into, one of which, graffitied to the base of the pole, read, hashtag what an arse looks like, which apparently viraled quite well on Twitter. Incidentally, I did tweet this from my Twitter account. I'm proud to be the first hashtag of this particular tweet. So when you listen to this, please tweet me. Hashtag what an arse looks like, or on Instagram, either's fine, that'd be wonderful, or Facebook even. Hashtag what an arse looks like. The old lady, who might have been called Mrs. Kitty Stavaker or Kent Shreveport, and might have lived at Riverbank or Ravel's Bilko, we'll never know. The handwriting of the hospital discharge notes left a lot to be desired. With an apparent letter on the side from Mr. Stavaker's husband saying he's at the pub watching the football, the medics take Kitty to bed whilst they bemoan the inconsiderate husband for not being present. And when Victor returns from the football, his team, I don't know if it's Arsenal, could be a different team. I know it's Arsenal in the show. They lost 4-1, as opposed to 4-0 in the series. He settles for the night as he kisses his, air quotes, wife goodnight. Back at the hotel, Gregory is dining with Margaret in his bedroom. It's all rather cosy and romantic. There's quite the feast going on, and Margaret is racked with nerves at this point. David has described Gregory's food carving skills in the form of a euphemism almost, and I quote, Gregory slid his knife into the sole just below its head and scored through the skin, working slowly down the spine and in a sawing action. Cutting at a slight angle to expose the flesh, he drew out the fillet from the bone and lay it among the sautéed broad beans and potatoes. Gregory addresses the fact that Margaret hasn't brought Victor along with her. Margaret passes this off as, well, I left the ironing board at home. Some things you know you're not going to need. A little harsh, I think, from Margaret. And then again, she did every so often come out with these harsh one-liners, didn't she, about Victor. Margaret brings up the YouTube video she'd seen the other night. And it's not really explained what went on other than Gregory reporting during a conflict. He talks of how he looks unrecognisable now, with much of a head of hair and a huge beard he had back then. Margaret's fishing for compliments as she pokes fun at what she looked like when she was younger, with Gregory responding, I'm sure I would have approved. Margaret later has Gregory in stitches as she brings up the incident earlier with Victor in the paramedic van with the yellow bucket and its slit. The time by now is 9 o'clock and they could both sense an atmosphere of sorts. An obvious one, sexual perhaps? Suddenly the hotel room buzzer goes off, which brings them both to their feet. The following two people are described as being the man in the long black coat and his tall blonde companion, Gregory, looking on in horror. And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave that there for this week. It's quite a chunk of a review, and I want to give your ears a rest for at least a week. No more than a week. Leaving you on a cliffhanger there, unfortunately, with Gregory and Margaret in a hotel room with a couple of strangers turning up. I wonder what happens next. Thank you so much for downloading and listening to me waffle on as ever. Drop me a line. Let me know what your thoughts are so far on the chapters I've discussed. And just general observations, really. And if you have read the book, of course, I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, how I've interpreted things and what your thoughts overall with the storylines. Thanks so much, everyone, for downloading. I look forward to hearing from you guys. And I'll be with you again next time. Cheers.